Hello, and welcome to the inaugural edition of Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we'll bring you stories on all things chemical, from the air we breathe to the cream we put in our coffee. We'll look back to the foundations of the chemical sciences, explore issues in contemporary scientific fields, and look ahead to future possibilities in the science of matter. This is Distillations. Perhaps the most recognizable icon in all of science is the periodic table of elements. This chart has become our model for how atoms and molecules arrange themselves to create matter as we know it, how the world is organized on the most minute level. Throughout history, the periodic table has changed. Newly discovered elements have been added to it, and other elements have been disproved and either modified or removed. In this way, the periodic table acts like a store of the history of chemistry, a template for current developments, and a basis for the future of the chemical sciences. In this and every episode of Distillations, we will explore an element in this map of the world's most basic building blocks. We'll call it the element of the week. This element may come from the periodic table as we know it today, or an element from the earliest days of chemical discovery, or an element whose existence was first believed, then contested, and finally dismissed. Such was the case with our first element, phlogiston. Our executive producer, Audra Wolfe, is here to explain how phlogiston was first discovered and how it was later replaced by the most breathable of elements, oxygen.
17th century chemists were perplexed by things that burn. They created a number of theories that built upon the four classical elements of the ancient Greeks, fire, water, air, and earth, in hopes of explaining what new element caused a material to combust. By 1731, a German chemist, Georg Ernst Stahl, thought he had it figured out. All flammable materials, like wood, contained an element that he called phlogiston. Once the material was burned, the phlogiston was released, and the remaining dephlogisticated ash was considered the true form of the material. Think of it like a layer of dirt covering something removed from an archaeological dig. Once the dirt is removed, the true object is visible. Phlogiston had no color, odor, taste, or mass of its own, which explained why it couldn't be isolated or detected by itself. The theory also explained why some materials, once reduced to ash, could not be reignited. The phlogiston theory was weakened and eventually disproved a few decades later when scientists showed that certain materials could not burn without the presence of air. So something else, an element not contained within the substance itself, was causing the material to burn. The French scientist Antoine Lavoisier, now known as the father of modern chemistry, first recognized the existence of this invisible element and named it oxygen. He made the connection between the air we breathe, or respiration, and the process of combustion. He also showed oxygen's role in the corrosion, or oxidation, of metals, and contributed to the discovery of the makeup of water as oxygen and hydrogen. Remember the name Lavoisier. You'll hear it many times in future episodes of Distillations. This is Audra Wolfe with The Element of the Week.
Special thanks to Anke Timmerman for her research on phlogiston for this week's element. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Lavoisier conducted research on what makes things burn in Paris in the 1780s. Had he been living in London, he might have held a public scientific demonstration to show his work to both colleagues and the curious. By far, the most famous of the public lecturers was Michael Faraday, whose Friday evening lectures at the Royal Institution in the 1820s and 30s brought news of the latest scientific findings to London's fashionable classes. Paul Smith is the director of lecture demonstrations in the chemistry department at Purdue. For the past 15 years, he has been performing reenactments of Michael Faraday's Christmas lectures, complete with period costume and language. He spoke to me of Faraday's broad popularity. Paul, please conjure the scene. Take us back in time. Describe the theater, the stage, the audience, the atmosphere.
You'd be going to a theater that had such a powerful influence on a London community that they changed the street Albemarle around to be a one-way street to handle the traffic flow. And so audience would come in full excitement, sometimes bringing their young children, and he would come out into this horseshoe kind of shaped, a U-shaped bench, fully loaded with all these different apparatuses and things that would even further pique their curiosity. And then he would simply talk his way through the demonstrations. And he was firmly convinced that you shouldn't tell something that you didn't show. And so he would describe, show, and the atmosphere described there by some of the people is just electrifying. They talk about his elegance and his compelling attention, which insisted upon sympathy. Just the verbiage, you get the sense of this guy really could sway the audience and really convey the importance of what he was talking about and communicate. He could educate, even though that wasn't primarily what they came for. I think it was a form of entertainment to them.
His lectures covered a wide range of topics, which focused on whatever he happened to be studying at the time. Could you describe one of his most interesting public experiments?
I think the most interesting, and this is personal opinion, and there's a wide range, as you said, so, but the one I think I would focus on was his chemical history of the candle and the different lectures there. And as you just sit there and you look at the candle and you hear him describing it, and of course we have the exact dialogue that he used, he brings you into understanding the chemistry of what's going on in that flame and how there's different parts to it. And he talks about extracting the flame's products, the gases, and describing them. And then he brings it into everyday terms and talks about an employer who told his servants how they could take the candle and hold it close to the ceiling and using the soot provided from that write messages on the ceiling with the candle. And so he enraptures the audience describing this candle at the same time fully informing them at the best understood chemistry that was going on in that flame, which was profound because this met everybody's level. They all were using candles. I mean, this is before electricity. This is the guy that's going to tell us about electricity and begin the whole era that we live in now with the use of electricity.
When you recreate Faraday's lectures in his persona, how do audiences react?
I think because of being dressed in a wig and an outdated tux because of the time frame of what clothing they wore, they're curious. They want to see, well, what is this guy about? What is he doing? Then because of the demonstrations in themselves, which communicate better than I can, I just try not to get too much in the way of the demonstration, communicate enough information. I think their interest continues, and I found them generally well-received. I don't know that they totally understand Michael Faraday because he comes from such a different time frame, and it's just hard for me sometimes to think about the fact this is all prior to electricity, and many of the things that we just take so commonplace, they didn't have any of these modern-day conveniences, and so I try to get the people to understand some of that stuff, and I think that kind of fascinates them to realize how people dealt with life without these things.
You mentioned making use of Faraday's lectures on the candle. They had the advantage in that day of picking an object in everybody's experience and taking people in unusual and new directions and understanding what made the thing work, a candle. Mindful that we are in a heavy digital age, we're deluged with imagery, how do people respond with taking on that simple candle and explicating it scientifically?
I'm surprised that they pay as attention as well as they do. It's a tough sell, and you're exactly right, and that's one of the things that I'm challenged by. Am I really going to capture their attention? Are they going to pay attention to this because they're seeing so many images, and are they just going to stay focused on a simple candle, which to them is very simple and foreign almost? You know, we use them so little. But if I communicate clearly and using his words and using his description and allow them to absorb some of the things there, it's interesting to watch an audience of several hundred people become rather enraptured with a simple flame burning in a candle.
That was Paul Smith, Director of Lecture Demonstrations in the Chemistry Department at Purdue University. And that's it for this premiere episode of Distillations. We'd like to leave you each week with an historic quotation, something to ponder until next time. This week's quotation is from Primo Levi's 1975 book, The Periodic Table. Distilling is a slow, philosophic, and silent occupation, which keeps you busy but gives you time to think of other things, somewhat like riding a bike. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbury Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indivero, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music was composed by Dave Kaufman. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. You can also check out our website at distillations.chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.